This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. The word fascism is cropping up more and more in U.S. political analyses. The leadership style of Donald Trump and the comfort he gives to extreme white nationalists has led many to wonder if the United States is indeed slipping into fascism. It's an easy word to throw around, but it does have a technical meaning and a particular history, one most closely associated with Europe. But historian Michael Joseph Roberto argues that while Mussolini and Hitler were creating the brand in Europe, a type of fascist ideology was already taking hold in the United States. He argues that monopoly finance capitalism and the power of corporate business over personal liberties is America's own kind of fascism. Michael Joseph Roberto is a former professor and contemporary world history at North Carolina A&T State University. He's an activist and former journalist. His book is called The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. Michael, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here. So let's do some parsing here, because, you know, the word fascism is being thrown around. When we use it, when it gets used in popular parlance, what are we saying when we use it commonly? Because I want to get to a more technical definition. But when you hear it in the press and people throwing it around, what do you think they mean? What do you think they mean?
Well, many people are talking about fascism. When they talk about fascism, what comes to mind is, as you said, Europe. The rise of Mussolini and Hitler to create dictatorships in Italy and Germany in the interwar period. And both these manifestations of fascism in the contemporary world were products of capitalist contradictions in those countries. But what is striking about those manifestations is that fascism arose as a result of movements from below, essentially movements that were driven by what we call the lower middle class or the petty bourgeoisie, both led by charismatic, fiery leaders who railed against the working class and the threat of socialism from below, but also against the big bankers and the big industrialists above them who were ruining their countries. And so what resulted in Europe in this interwar period were fascist dictatorships, which seemed to represent to the world something unique and phenomenally different from anything that had happened in the rest of the liberal capitalist world, Britain, France.
Right. So let's talk more about these contradictions, the fact that capitalism had failed once again, 1929, not for the first time, but cataclysmically and universally. This was a global catastrophe.
Yes.
That was really hurting working class and as you say, middle class people. What's the answer? When we think of fascism, we think of the totalitarianism, and we think of the racism, the essential anti-Semitism, racism, and nationalism that went with it. Those are the toxic effects. But they were also addressing an economy that had been destroyed by capitalism.
Yes.
First thing they did was to nationalize the economy, so in a way they're kind of socialist.
Yes.
So talk more about the anxieties that they were addressing and the broader kind of, and the ways in which capitalism was the catalyst for this movement itself.
Well, let me answer this way. It is important for us to recognize that in both Italy and Germany, capitalism was saved, and it was saved from the threat of socialism and a revolutionary alternative that came from below. In this country, fascism took a different form. It didn't come from below in the form of a mass movement led by a dictator. It came from the very top, and this is because fascism is itself a function of monopoly finance capitalism. By that, I mean that in the drive of capitalism, of capital itself to accumulate constantly, that makes the entities of corporations, of large companies, what in the 1930s Americans whose works I talk about in my book called Big Business and Wall Street. For these people in the 30s and the early 40s who were writing, the driving force of fascism was big business. Two writers in 1938 said that Wall Street was the fountainhead of fascism. And when we look at these writers in the U.S. in the 1930s, we began to understand that fascism is not something that just happened in Europe in the 1920s and the 1930s. Fascism is unique to the contemporary world because it is a product of capitalist development. And in the United States, after World War I, what we see is a rising empire that is the epicenter of the world capitalist system. And so the drive to build a capitalist economy at an even greater heights, what we in historians and political scientists call capitalist modernization, what we find is that many of these writers in the 1930s saw fascism inherent in capitalist modernization.
But why call it fascism? Why not just a successful, less toxic version of capitalism? Here's the way you do it right, Germany and Italy. You do it with democracy. You have a democratic republic, and you allow everybody to participate in the economic development of the country. So why call that fascism?
Because fascism in itself meant the destruction of liberal capitalist democracy. But in the United States, again, going back to these writers argued, and they were communists, they were socialists, they were what we would today call progressives of various stripes, left liberals, people who actually had a critique of liberalism and saw how liberalism actually helped to further fascist development. These people saw that fascism in the U.S. would come in the name of democracy. It would come in the name of the Constitution.
Tell us how that worked. Tell us how that worked and what effect it had.
Well, it has. I think you have to, and hopefully folks will read my book. I think it's something that you can get through. It's not a quick read, but you can get through it. But fascism is embryonic in capitalist modernization itself in the U.S. in the 1920s. It comes in basically two forms. It comes in a terrorist form and a non-terrorist form. The terrorist form we see early, right after World War I, when labor rises up against capital. We see strikes all over the country in 1919, and then we see a wave of repression on the part of the government that is aimed at the working class, but the cover for that is that the workers are being led down the road by the communists, and we're afraid that the Bolsheviks are going to take over America. Well, labor is quickly pacified in the early 20s, but then we see the other part of fascism, which is the attempt to mold the American people on the basis of commodification advertising, which basically makes people acquiesce and accommodate themselves to the power of capital. So what we see during the so-called great boom of the 1920s is this gradual sort of coordination of American society where capitalist imperatives become paramount to the drive of big business to constantly expand. Now, this has two fundamental sort of avenues. One, domestically, is that we turn the public into consumers, into people who think that real democracy is in the marketplace rather than in the polling place. And this is the really insidious part of it, is that capitalist modernization in America as the beacon of democracy also looks toward Europe and finds that its most reliable partner in Europe in the 1920s is fascist Italy. So, for example, in my book, I talk about a meeting of the International Chamber of Commerce in Rome in 1923 that attracts 1,000 people from various parts of various countries in Europe, the United States. The largest delegation are Americans, 200 American members of the Chamber of Commerce, who are all big businessmen in their own right. And they come back to the U.S. and they say, Mussolini is great. This is just what we need.
Well, now, I'm going to stop you there because I do want to talk about this important link that I think, again, we miss when we think about fascism only in terms of totalitarianism and in nationalism, that it is really the link between business, big corporate business,
yes,
and government, so that government becomes the enforcement arm. Government protects the supply chain. We all pay taxes to protect the supply chain for corporations. Yes. That's the way a good fascist government will work. We can keep it running efficiently. Yeah. Just don't complain about your wages. Right. Just don't complain about the environment that we're ruining in the process. In fact, you'll love all the consumer products to the point that you're not even going to notice that we're ruining your environment. You're even going to buy devices that will spy on you because it's convenient. I mean, this is part of the of the progress of this, right?
Yes, yeah. Right. It's the world turned upside down, really, when you think about it. As consumers, when we think about what we buy and why we buy it, why we buy things that we don't need, why do we do this? It's because of advertising. Well, who's behind the advertising? Well, in the 1920s, big business called in psychologists. So you had these corporations of psychologists forming that were basically telling the gurus in advertising and public relations how to mold consciousness, how to get people to buy when they didn't need something. And it's fascinating stuff. I mean, writing this book was humbling to me.
Well, because you're talking about Edward Bernays and the rise of public relations and a moment in capitalism, which actually Marx had predicted, one of the moments when he's spot on. And he says, you know, they're going to get so good at developing this industrial technology, they're going to become so efficient that eventually they're going to overproduce the things that we need. And at that point, prices are going to crash and the whole thing will go away and we'll all live happily ever after. Yes. Something like that. I think that was in volume three. And he was kind of right about that. What he was wrong about, what we didn't predict, was that a guy like Edward Bernays and the rise of public relations through psychology would say, I wonder if we can get these people not only to buy what they need, but to buy what they want, to buy things that become their identity. I wonder if we can get them to attach their identity to products in a way that makes it impossible for them not to buy. Think this through. Humankind did not evolve by wasting its resources and using things. You can't imagine a tribal chieftain saying, you aren't using your sandals fast enough. Use more leather, right? But that's precisely how our economy is based. So he got people actually buying things they don't need, buying things, and that was what actually saved capitalism, right?
I think what the most difficult part of my book for people to grasp is that the drive to do this, the drive to turn the whole society into a marketplace, to make everyone a consumer, is necessary because of the processes of capitalist accumulation. In other words, here we go from a kind of understanding of politics and historical development to something even deeper and more difficult to understand, and that is what we call political economy. When you read chapter 2 of my book, you will see that this drive to make people consumers, this drive to bring everybody on board, to create this sense that America is always going to prosper no matter what, is based on the laws of capitalist development itself. And this is where some folks like me would get into trouble with liberals, because the basis for this kind of argument is found in Marxist political economy itself. So, for example, in chapter 2, I actually talk about a chapter in volume 1 of Marx's Capital, and how he explains how in all economic growth under capitalism, what you get is greater growth, but you get rising poverty in a sea of plenty. In other words, it's a paradox. And we saw this clearly in the 1920s, because the 1920s is supposed to be a period of a great boom in America. Well, at the end of the 1920s, after the Wall Street crash, and then people started to look at this, what they found about the 1920s was that it wasn't prosperity for all. There were 120 million people in the country, and almost 70% of the population was living at or below what was then considered to be a decent standard of living. So that was a myth. The Great Boom was a myth. But then the contradictions, again, of capitalism. overproduction, underconsumption, and the financialization of the economy, which led big banks to invest more in the stock market than in productive things, led to the crash. And then when the crash came, then the whole repressive mechanism of capitalist modernization becomes overtly fascist.
Is this the thing that I've given you 30 seconds for this answer. Given the fact that we are so seduced and so narcotized by this economy, and we believe somehow that we're actually participating in the democracy, is there a way out of this?
Yes, I think there is. I think the first way out is we need to educate ourselves about fascism and its connection to capitalism. And we need to see that from the standpoint of our own history. And we need to understand, and the best way to do that is to take a close look at what's happening now. Trump is a very dangerous man. What he represents is very dangerous. It's very easy for me to say that Trump is a fascist, but it's more difficult for me to try to argue with people that Trump is a product of a system that has gone into a deep crisis. And the cause of that crisis is not Trump, it's not ultra-nationalism, it's not the efficient cause, the main cause is not white supremacy. These are all symptomatic of the crisis, but the cause of the crisis is the fact that the American empire is now on its last leg and will do anything it can in order to survive. And this is the domain of Wall Street, of big business, what the Occupy movement called the 1% not too long ago.
Michael Joseph Roberto, the book is called The Coming of the American Behemoth, The Origins of Fascism in the United States, 1920 to 1940. Thank you so much for being
on
the program.
Thank you for having me.
You can find a link to the book at our website, stateofthings.org, North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. Once again, the music of Bless Nova.
I am a beautiful soul that was loved.